Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Poor black men often get locked up in America. Poor black women get locked out, evicted from their homes for being unable to pay their rent, for complaining about what needs fixing, even for calling 911 too often, regardless of the reason. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Those stark conclusions came from recent MacArthur Genius Laureate Matthew Desmond. He's John L. Loeb Associate Professor in the Social Sciences Department at Harvard University and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project. A few years ago, driven to understand the effects of housing stress on the country's poorest families, he moved into a ramshackle trailer park and then a rooming house in economically troubled sections of Milwaukee, staying for months at a time to gain the trust and learn the stories of his neighbors. He saw many trying earnestly to hang on to their housing, only to lose not just the roof over their heads, but also most of their possessions when they were kicked out, by landlords often making a large margin of profit. The combination of his field research and academic studies led him to recognize that eviction can be a cause of poverty rather than simply the other way around. His new book is called Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matt Desmond, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
How does eviction cause poverty?
When you step back and look at the consequences of eviction, there are many and they're severe. You know, eviction causes loss. Families not only lose their homes, but kids lose their schools. You lose your community and your neighbors. You do often lose your possessions, which are either taken by movers and locked up or piled on the sidewalk to be picked apart. It takes a lot of money and time to establish a home. Eviction can erase all that. Eviction often comes with a record. And that can bar you from accessing decent, affordable housing. Many landlords turn you away if you have a recent eviction on your name. Public housing authorities do the same, which means we're systematically denying families that need help the most. We're denying them that aid. So families are pushed into worse housing and into worse neighborhoods. We know both of those things are really bad for kids' health. We have good evidence that eviction causes job loss. And anyone out there listening who's been evicted knows why. It's such a consuming, stressful, drawn-out event that can cause you to make mistakes at work, lose your footing in the labor market. And then there's the eviction cost on your spirit or your mental health. We have evidence that mothers who get evicted have higher rates of depression 2 years later. So I could go on, but, you know, you kind of step back and look at the full picture, and I think you have to conclude that eviction isn't just a bad day, and it's just not just a condition of poverty. It's a cause of it. It's making things worse.
You did your research in Milwaukee, but you say what you saw there is happening in cities all over America.
We've now crunched the data in Kansas City, in Chicago, and Cleveland. New York City sees 60 Marshall evictions every single day. This is a book that's set in Milwaukee, but it does tell a broader American story. We know from national data that renters in over 2.8 million homes think that they'll be evicted soon. So this isn't just a Boston, New York story. It's happening in the South, in the middle of the country, in Rust Belt cities like Milwaukee. It's a widespread problem.
Matt, people fortunate enough not to have found themselves in this situation or close to it might think, well, what about federal housing assistance? I was stunned to read how many people are eligible but don't receive local or federal benefits.
Yeah, that's right. I think that many of us still believe that most low-income families today live in public housing or benefit in some way from the government for their housing costs. But the opposite is true. Today, only about 1 in 4 families that qualify for assistance receive it. It's not because they don't meet certain requirements or, you know, are ineligible for some other reason. There's just not enough aid to go around. That situation would be pretty unthinkable when it comes to other basic needs. Imagine if we turned away 3 in 4 families that apply for food stamps, you know, say, sorry, you have to go hungry. But that's exactly how we treat low-income families seeking affordable shelter today. The waiting list for public housing in some of our biggest cities is not counted in years. It's counted in decades. So a young parent in Washington, D.C., for example, who applied for public housing today would probably be a grandparent by the time her or his application came up for review.
Tell us about your time in Milwaukee. Where specifically did you live, and how did you begin to get to know people in your neighborhood?
I wanted to understand poverty in America. You know, America's unique. It's the richest democracy with the worst poverty. And I wanted to know what role housing played in that story. And I started the old-fashioned way. I just moved to the city, and I rented a trailer in a trailer park on the south side of Milwaukee. And I lived there for about 5 months. And then I moved to the north side of Milwaukee, which is the inner city. And I rented a room in a rooming house. And I lived there for about 10 months. And from those two neighborhoods followed families getting evicted, but also their landlords doing the evicting. I knew that if I really wanted to understand the issue and its full complexity, I had to get landlords' perspectives as much as tenants' perspectives. So I did. So if you were getting evicted, I wanted to get just as close with your landlord as I did with you. And I followed these families everywhere. You know, I went to eviction court with them, watched them move, stayed at their homes, ate from their tables, followed them to abandoned homes and shelters, watched their kids, went to funerals with them, was even there for a birth. And on the landlord side of things, I kind of understood what makes them tick and what ticks them off, you know, why they would buy properties in some very distressed neighborhoods, why they evict you but not me. Try to put all that information together in a new kind of story about poverty and profit in our cities today.
As an academic, I imagine you've never lived large, but was it still an eye-opener to live in the places that you did in Milwaukee?
Absolutely. Absolutely it was. I mean, there is an incredible amount of suffering in this rich land. And I remember seeing, being on this one eviction where we went into a home and it was just kids in the house. Mm. And what had happened was the mom had died and the kids had just gone on living in this apartment. And it was kind of a cold spring day, raining. And the sheriff moved the kids out. Our movers piled their stuff on the wet sidewalk. The landlord changed the locks, and we were off to the next eviction. I think seeing things like that does get under your skin. And evicted is a chronicling of the state of poverty in America today. But that chronicling is incomplete without stories of humor and courage and intelligence and guts in the face of adversity. So Evicted has stories about that, too, because they remind me how gracefully people refuse to be reduced to their hardships.
You wrote about one guy who I think most of us could forgive for doing very little. He was severely disabled. He was an amputee. And yet he was trying really hard to sort of work off his debts by working for his landlord.
Yeah, so this is Lamar. And Lamar was this fixture in his neighborhood. He was really gregarious, outgoing, whip-smart man, single dad. And he was trying to raise two adolescent boys in a very poor neighborhood in inner city Milwaukee. And he was wheelchair-bound. He was a double amputee and fell behind in the rent and did try to work it off. He cleaned out a filthy basement for his landlord, and then he painted a unit for his landlord, kind of crawled around on his stubs, really, painting and praying for strength. I helped him out the last day of painting. So he gave it his best shot. It's all he could do, but his landlord didn't accept it. And I think that in Lamar's story, there's a lot of takeaways, but one takeaway is, you know, Lamar's house was a really important house for this block. It was all where the neighborhood boys went after school, and they played cards, and they laughed, and they joked, and Lamar made sure they had a good time, but he also talked to them about homework, girls, sex, crime, the police. You know, that neighborhood, that block lost Lamar, and they lost him as a stabilizing presence in the neighborhood. And it shows that eviction doesn't only affect individuals or individual families, but whole communities as well.
Yeah, the fabric of the neighborhood, you know, can't strengthen when people are transient who had, you know, an emotional and social investment in that neighborhood.
That's right. And I think that, you know, this raises a question. How often does this happen? You know, how prevalent is eviction? And when you go to inner city Milwaukee, you learn that about 1 in 14 renter homes are evicted every single year. It's an incredible amount of instability. You know, sociologists, economists, policymakers have long known that poor families move a lot. And we've known that has big consequences on schools and on children. But we haven't known why. And I think one thing that this book shows us is, you know, they're moving so much because they're forced to. They just can't afford to stay in one place long enough. The community level effects of eviction are something we're just beginning to understand, but we have evidence that neighborhoods with more evictions have more violent crime the following year. And I think, you know, you can understand why when neighbors work together and invest in their communities, they can really make their neighborhoods safer. But as long as we have a lot of folks moving in and out of these communities, churning through these homes, we guarantee that neighbors will remain strangers, and that really dilutes the kind of civic potential found in low-income urban communities.
We're speaking this hour with Matthew Desmond, Associate Professor of the Social Sciences at Harvard University and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project. He was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant last year. His new book is called Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. He joins us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Matthew Desmond, who is John L. Loeb Associate Professor of the Social Sciences at Harvard University and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project. His new book is called Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. He joins us as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Matt, there are laws dictating minimum standards for housing quality and safety. How is it that a landlord can rent property that does not match building codes, has, say, holes in the walls or broken windows or unstable staircases? How is that possible?
Unless we address the underlying problem that so many poor families can't afford a roof over their head, we can't really legislate our way out of that problem. And the reason is because rights literally cost money. Hmm. You know, there's laws in the books, like you said, to protect families from living in dangerous and degrading conditions. But if you are a family like Arlene in Evicted, who's a single mom raising two boys who's spending 88% of her income just on rent to live in a very poor neighborhood, if you're someone like Arlene, you're going to have to ask your landlord's compassion one of these days. And so to report your landlord to a city inspector and to kind of enter into an adversarial relationship with your landlord to have housing code enforced is to invite eviction if you're behind in your rent. Landlords can't retaliate against tenants who, you know, report those problems, but they can evict someone anytime for being behind. And so families who are income strapped, who are giving 60, 70, 80% of their income on housing, they can trade their dignity and their kids' health for a roof over their head.
So the tacit message to tenants is don't you dare complain because it'll cost you.
I think so. And, you know, the other side of the story about the lack of public housing and, you know, any kind of government help for housing assistance is the fact that today we've reached a point where the majority of poor renting families are spending at least half their income on housing. And one in four of those families are spending at least 70% just on rent and utilities. So under those conditions, you don't need a major event or a huge setback to invite eviction. Something very innocent and small can do it. It's eviction for families like that, for people like Arlene, is much more of a result of inevitability than personal irresponsibility. And tenants in those situations do kind of make trade-offs with their landlord so they can have a roof over their head.
And then once you've been evicted, who else wants to rent to you?
Not a lot of people, you know. And so a lot of landlords that rent decent housing and safe neighborhoods often have pretty high bars for their tenants, you know. And so they turn families away with recent evictions on their name, recent being, you know, within the last 2 or 3 years. That's the mechanism that explains why families that get evicted move from poorer neighborhoods to even poorer ones and why they live in housing that's in much worse condition than the housing that they were evicted from. And so you're right. I mean, that mark or that blemish of eviction can really affect your housing choices.
It would be really easy to make landlords, and in some cases, these are slumlords, out to be just pure evil. But your portrait of the folks that you came to know is more nuanced than that.
I think we let ourselves off the hook if we say, oh, these tenants, they're just irresponsible. Or, oh, these landlords, they're just greedy. I do think that if you look at the problem very closely, it is complicated. And you see landlords in my book at turns buying families groceries, bailing people out of jail, letting someone slide. But you also see them at other times, you know, being pretty hard-nosed business people and sometimes evicting you for calling 911 or reporting housing problems to the city. So I do think this relationship, the landlord-tenant relationship, is an old one. It's a fraught one, but it's also very complicated. If we're going to house most of our low-income families in the private market, landlords have to be part of the solution. They have to be at the table.
Explain to folks this consequence of a tenant calling 911 too often in any given month and therefore being susceptible to eviction.
So in Milwaukee and cities all across the United States, including Dallas, there are nuisance ordinances which hold landlords accountable for their tenants' behavior. That behavior is usually measured by excessive 911 calls. So in Milwaukee, you know, it's like 3 911 calls within a month. Your property can be deemed a nuisance. And when that happens, you as a landlord get a letter saying, hey, you need to abate the nuisance, fix the problem or else. And that or else is really scary. You know, you can get fined thousands of dollars. You can lose your property. So when I was talking to landlords about this, they said, you know, people are saying these laws are for noise or for, drugs or, you know, things like that, you know, kind of nuisance properties in cities. But, you know, a lot of the times the folks calling are domestic violence victims. They're the ones that are calling 911 so much. And I said, well, what did you do when you get a letter? And they'd say, we evict the tenant. You know, that's what we do. And so I ended up analyzing 2 years' worth of nuisance citations from Milwaukee and found that the landlords were right. You know, about every 4 days, landlords get a letter with domestic violence-related activity. And in over 80% of the cases, they evict the tenant. So we're putting domestic violence survivors in this really terrible situation where they can either call 911 and risk eviction or not pick up the phone and risk more abuse. The good news is that when we shared this information with Milwaukee Police Department, they changed their law. They changed their law. And they made it the case that domestic violence is no longer acceptable as a nuisance. The unfortunate news is that in many cities across the country, we suspect that these relationships or these dynamics are still going on.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Sean on the line in Dallas. Hello, Sean.
Yeah, hey, I'm just calling just about the money situation that people find themselves in. And I'm saying it has not having enough income. Social Security, some people are on Social Security. I think the most that they get is like $740 a month, you know, and they may or may not get food stamps, you know. So I think there's a problem with the minimum wage and also, with the assistance that Social Security gives, and I think that ends up being more of a problem than the tenants or the landlords, themselves.
What do you think, Matt?
It's an important point, you know, and you know, Milwaukee lost 53,000 jobs between 1979 and 1983. That's more than during the Great Depression, and you know, the city became a city where almost everyone was employed to a city that had poverty rates in the double digits. And, you know, cities like Milwaukee, Buffalo, Cleveland just haven't recovered from that. The jobs just aren't there. But I think poverty is two-pronged. It's not only the result of low incomes, but it's also the result of, you know, extractive markets or kind of what some people might call exploitation. And I think history bears this out where, you know, over the generations, we've seen workers fighting for higher wages or going on strike to do that and that kind of thing. And once they get those wages, the housing market learns to recoup those gains. And so I do think when it comes to fixing this problem, we do need to be smart about incomes and giving people a living wage, but we also need to address housing crisis, the lack of affordable housing in our cities.
Some landlords are disinclined to rent to people with children. First of all, is that even legal?
It is not legal. It's protected under the Fair Housing Act.
But what happens in practice?
Well, what I saw was that, folks with children face high levels of housing discrimination. You know, some landlords will just say, we don't want your kids, ma'am. We know from audit studies that families with children face discrimination in as many out of 7 out of 10 housing searches. We know that many folks don't even recognize family discrimination as discrimination. You know, they say, okay, you can't turn away folks based on their race or their gender, but you can turn away kids. You know, you can have an adult-only property. That's against the law. But in practice, it's still very much going on. The fact of the matter is, you know, folks that get evicted, you know, the eviction epidemic in America, the face of that epidemic is moms with kids. It's so many kids. You know, the majority of households in Milwaukee that get evicted have kids. Until recently, the South Bronx Housing Court in New York City had a daycare because there were so many kids coming through its doors. So for families like that, that are just trying to avoid homelessness after their eviction, they don't really have time to think about discrimination. They just dial a number, another number. But that's precisely why many of those families, you know, have to apply for 50, 60, 70, 80 apartments before someone says yes.
And those aren't indiscriminate numbers. You've seen that happening.
I count it. I remember being with Arlene once after an eviction, and it took her 2 months to find a one-bedroom apartment in a pretty bad neighborhood. After her eviction court hearing, you know, she called on or applied to 90 places. And not only is that just exhausting, it creates massive amount of instability in the family, and it doesn't give the kids really a chance to kind of invest in their schools or in their neighborhoods. Her kids missed many, many days of school during this time because Arlene just thought finding them a new place to live was like a higher order priority.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Steve on the line in Carrollton. Hello, Steve.
Hi, I appreciate you taking my call. It's an important subject. And it is interesting how we look at things from different perspectives. I think if you look back at the 50-plus year war on poverty and the utter disaster that it's been in creating dependence, unemployment, destroyed families, I mean, I believe the greatest prevention for economic despair is a two-parent family. And the family has been absolutely decimated in these inner cities. Just like you to comment on that.
I think that it's tough for us to remember that before the war on poverty, the poverty rate in America was double what it is today. And the nation decided to take that on. And the programs that resulted in that were hugely effective at reducing poverty all throughout America and keeping it low since the war on poverty. I think that, you know, poverty is never just poverty, right? It's this kind of festering constellation of correlated adversity. There is single-parent families. There's exposure to certain crimes sometimes. There's joblessness in the inner city. I think that if we care about giving families a chance, a shot at stability and longevity, if we care about giving folks a shot at economic mobility, we have to give them a stable, affordable place to live.
Matthew Desmond is my guest. He's associate professor of the social sciences at Harvard, co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project. His new book is called Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. If you want to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. I'm also on Twitter at Chris Boyd Thinks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Programming note here, for the second year in a row, the Think team will be traveling to Washington, D.C. for a week of live broadcast that will begin next Monday, the 25th. Our guests include members of the North Texas Congressional Delegation, National Park Service Director Jonathan Jarvis, Nina Totenberg of NPR, and a lot of other big-name guests to be named soon. We have them on the schedule, but we will let you know exactly who's coming as the time draws closer. Again, that starts Monday, April 25th. All that special coverage from D.C. You can follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC. Returning now to our guest for the hour, Matthew Desmond. He was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant last year, and he is co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project. His new book is called Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, and you can join our conversation at 800-933-5372. It is really heartbreaking, Matt, to think about children wishing for something as simple as a decent place to live. You know, most of us, many of us listening, I should say, maybe not most, are lucky enough that our kids wish for, like, a bike for their birthdays or things like that. Will you tell us about Ruby and the time she spent on the computer at the library near her house?
Yeah. So Ruby was this really smart girl when I met her. She lived in a very small two-bedroom apartment and with the Hingston family. And the Hingston family was kind of run by Doreen, who is the kind of grandma of the family there. She had four kids, and then one of her oldest kid had three kids. And they were all kind of crammed into this really small two-bedroom. And, you know, because there were so many folks living in there, and also because the landlord kind of started divesting from the place and not fixing things up, it just started to deteriorate. You know, a door fell on Ruby once. There were cockroaches spread out. The plumbing stopped up. And the family took to calling the place the rat hole. Hmm. And, you know, one thing Ruby and her siblings would do would be to walk to a library nearby. And she played this game that at the time was free online. And it was kind of like SimCity or something, where you build your own home. And she built her own home, and she had this, you know, beautiful little home with a desk and the pencils and pencil holder. And, you know, there's a pillow and a pillowcase. You know, these are things that many, many of us might take for granted. But if you're someone like Ruby slept in a chair when I met her, you know, you don't take those for granted. And I do think, you know, it speaks to this deep longing for home and the centrality of home. It's the center of life. You know, it's our wellspring of personhood and our refuge from the streets. It's, you know, without a stable shelter, everything else does fall apart.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We'll speak with Brent in Grand Prairie. Hi, Brent.
Hi.
Hi.
Great program.
Thank
Difficult
you.
Topic. Wow. I'm a landlord. I've been doing it for 20 years. And I just wanted to reinforce what your guest is saying. And then there are just so many sides to it. As a landlord, it makes good sense and good business to try to provide quality living conditions to people. And yet you get things, you see the system and it's broken. You see people that are left by the welfare system or housing or whatever, because they break some rules, and then they're your responsibility. And I have tenants that have been just abandoned by the programs, left in the house, and I have to evict them. And then on the other side, I've had people that I've provided beautiful quality shelter, and they don't have basic skills and understanding on how to take care and clean their own environment. I've had parents that don't buy toilet paper, so the kids are flushing rags down the toilet. That's what causes the plumbing problems. How many times do I go out there and fix it? Do I evict them? What do I do? So just amazing, important topic, and so many sides to it. And thank you for the program.
Thanks for your call, Brent. Is there anything you heard there, Matt, that you want to respond to or comment on?
You know, poverty's not pretty. You know, it's not pretty. And I think that, you know, you have folks like Brent out there that are trying to make a living, that are trying to offer decent, affordable housing. And he's absolutely right to say, you know, it's kind of his problem. You know, I do think that we've withdrawn our attention from some of our very poor families today. And we've asked landlords to kind of clean up the mess in some states, in some cities. And it's a tough situation out there. Some of the things that might look like poverty or might look like irresponsibility can be coping mechanisms. There can be mental health issues involved. There can be not enough money to buy toilet paper sometimes. And it does raise really important questions. And I think that people like Brent, like I said before, have to be part of the solution. I think that, you know, the book kind of advocates for taking, you know, how do we fix this problem? What do we do about it? And the book advocates for taking a program that we already have, a housing voucher program, and expanding it to everyone below the poverty line. And I think that, you know, that would fundamentally change the face of poverty in America, would plunge down evictions and family homelessness. And I think folks like Brent would really be behind that program.
So I want to talk about this, Matt. If I were a developer and had money to put into a new housing block, it might make more sense to me. My investors might be happier with me if I built something that would rent for a lot rather than building affordable housing. How do we incentivize the construction of new decent units that people at or even below the poverty line might be able to pay for?
It's a tough question, but building our way out of this is only part of the solution. If you look at the vacancy rates in a lot of our cities, including in Texas, like Houston has 11% vacancy rate, Milwaukee, Baltimore, Toledo, they have double-digit vacancy rates. A lot of times we do have the stock. Mm. We do have places that folks can live in. It's not a matter of we need to build more. It's a matter of we need to offer folks the ability to pay rents in some of our worst neighborhoods. I think the broader point, though, here is like, you know, housing is too fundamental a human need. It is too central to human flourishing, children's well-being, and health to be treated just as a commodity. And I think that we've recognized this with other things. You know, we've affirmed provision in old age, 12 years of education, basic nutrition to be rights in this country, because we believe that those things are central to economic mobility and human development. And it's impossible to argue that shelter is not central to those things, too. I do think we have to work with the market to make a solution that's as big as the problem. But I don't think we can just treat housing as a commodity that just cashes out.
If we did universal housing vouchers for folks at or near the poverty line, would that inevitably drive up rents for people just above that level?
I used to think that. There's not a lot of evidence for that. You know, we used to think that 20 years ago when we kind of developed and rolled out vouchers in a major way, the evidence just really wasn't there for that concern. At least right now, we don't have enough vouchers to really make that big of a difference. I do think that if we provided more vouchers, I think that'd be something we need to watch. I don't know if the evidence is behind that yet, though.
Do you think that evictions are responsible for multi-generational poverty?
There are so many things that are responsible for multi-generational poverty, but eviction and lack of adequate housing is absolutely one of them. If we want to break the cycle of multi-generational poverty, we have to give kids a shot at a decent education. We have to give them a shot at allowing them to reach their full potential. We can't if we force families to be evicted from one place to another. You know, Arlene's 14-year-old son, Jory, went to 5 different schools between 7th and 8th grade. Hmm. If we want to give him a shot at being in a better position than his mom, we have to give him more stability. Another way to break multi-generational poverty is through job training, to allow parents to invest in themselves and invest in their children, to kind of get a firmer foothold in the labor market. If you're paying 70-80% of your income on housing, that's impossible to do. We do know that when families finally receive a housing voucher after years on the waiting list, when they finally receive this ticket that it allows them to only pay 30% of their income on housing, except not 50 or 60, they do one really consistent thing with their freed up income. They take it to the grocery store and they buy more food, and their kids become stronger and less anemic. But most poor families in the country aren't so lucky, and their kids, names like Jory, don't get enough to eat because the rent eats first. So if we do want to make a difference in stopping the cycle of poverty within families, housing has to be central to that plan.
Matthew Desmond is John L. Loeb, Associate Professor of the Social Sciences at Harvard University and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project. His new book is Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Matt, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thanks very much for making this time for us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.